Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Boys and girls, children of all ages, welcome to the Weird Things podcast with Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Oh, man, I knew it. I brought that cup up to my mouth, and I thought, I'm summoning the djinn to call upon me.
So. I wait to see Justin Robert Young.
Oh, God, jeez. Oh, man, I had a cup to my lips, too.
I wait to see where the cup goes to the lips.
Did you get an intentionally complimentary color to your red plastic cup here?
No, we actually just bought red cups, but when we first moved in. So this is totally...
This is amazing, though. We look like Wonder Twins here.
Or the Vision.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, the green and red, huh?
So the man you hear trying to speak as liquid trickles down his chin is Brian Brushwood. The man who has the wonderful strainer beard to capture said liquid is Justin Robert Young.
Hey, man.
It's amazing what gets caught in there, man. Like, it's liquids, dust, solids, animals. Like, it's amazing what you find in there. I found a doubloon yesterday. It was a great find.
I found a balloon.
Well, gentlemen. I want to jump right into it, speaking of finding things.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
I'm going to jump right in and tell you right now, Goblin, okay?
Goblin. Wow, no burying the lead on this one.
Oh, no.
We go
There's
full
a lead
frontal
here.
Goblin this- today on Weird Things.
So, periodically, we like to cover one of the biggest problems facing people in third world countries, and that is being terrorized by goblins.
It really is. Yeah.
And we've realized through our research that these may be actually cries for help and perhaps evidence that there is some sort of horrific sexual abuse taking place through maybe people using pharmaceuticals, et cetera, that cause weird hallucinations.
Or it could be goblins. I mean, let's not throw the baby out with the goblins.
True that.
I mean, you're right. It is, on one hand, thinly veiled metaphor, so the word can at least get out that horrifying things are happening. Yes. Or goblins.
So, I pick up stories when I find some interesting little twists, etc., like that. There are quite a lot of goblin stories out there, and there seem to be a lot of like terrorizing girl schools for something, but this is a different one. So talk about, like, there was a thing a couple weeks ago, some teachers threatened to quit their school district because of goblins in the workplace. And I'm thinking, like, if the teachers union here are looking for a new angle.
Oh, dude. Yeah. Imagine that, like the big Chicago teachers worker strike, you know, and Rahm Emanuel's like, hey, we need to do this certain stuff. And then the teachers are like, there's goblins in there and they're raping people.
And then the new thing is like, look, everyone knows there's a goblin problem. I think the goblin should have to register. I think if you see a goblin, say a goblin. Come on.
I think it's about time that we understand that the goblins need a pathway to human citizenship.
Look, they didn't come over here just because they love terrorizing children. It's even worse over in Goblinton.
So, new goblin twist. A woman by the name of Matsushita.
By the way, a great Dueda. Chubby Checkers song.
The goblin
twist. Let's twist again. The goblin twist, and then the new goblin twist, which was really at the end of the rope.
What really sucked is when he got together with the Fat Boys and started rapping over the goblin twist. Like, that was unnecessary. That was just cashing in.
All right, I'm so excited. This the goblin, the ever expanding goblin story is really my favorite thing. So what is new?
So I'm going to keep going, and then there's going to be a funny little bit of touchback right here. So 44-year-old Matsushita Lueda says her family's been terrified of a short tokolesh, which they describe as a goblin. It's been haunting the family, or the evil creature has haunted them for 14 years. She says, after I accessed my ancestral calling to be a Sangoma, the tokoleshi became very aggressive. I don't know what that means. Maybe something religious. And it says it choked her sleeping husband this Tuesday. They had to shake him to wake him. Now she said she and her husband share their bedroom with their six kids. We sleep together so we can shake each other when it chokes one of us. She said that the three-year-old used to say she was playing at night with a Nana none of them could see. Another child. That's another child none of them could see. When she played and the dog barked, we knew the Tokolesh, the goblin, was around. Now she cries when it's around. And it's understandable. We've had to, after several of these stories, we realized that goblin there kind of meant ghost.
Yeah.
But a much more physical ghost. So anyhow, now the little girl cries when it's around. Her son, 22, moved from the backyard shack into the family house after he said the goblin attacked him. When I fell asleep, it whispered into my ear and slapped me. I couldn't understand what the big voice was saying. His sister, named Beauty, says its footsteps are heavy. I've heard it roar at night in our bedroom window. They said they've had four traditional healers, but they're no match for the monster. They told me my strong ancestors protect my family because my kids would have been dead by now. I'm looking for a very strong Sangwoma to end our misery.
Just so I can get the right wrap around my mind around the culture, this is what part of the world this is in?
This, I think, is South Africa, I believe.
Okay. And is goblin just a catch-all term, or you know, we mentioned that it's similar to ghost, or it's here in the United States we tend to separate different physical medium. If it scares you in the forest, it must be a chupacabra or a Sasquatch or a Yeti or whatever. If it scares you in the bedroom, it must be a ghost.
This is from Zimbabwe, so Southern Africa, but not South Africa. Yeah, and so it seems to me ghost or spirit or something like that, and sometimes maybe being possessed. But this goblin, there's something special about this goblin. I had to read through here in my own monotone voice and take out certain elements to describe this goblin.
Have we heard the filtered version so far? Or
that was the filtered version.
Okay.
All right. Also understand that – like just the one guy, the 20-something-year-old who's like living in a shack out back, and it's like I don't know what happened with all these other goblin stories, but I'm sure as soon as they all started happening, the guy who's living in the shack is like, no, the goblin got me, I gotta move into the house now. All right, so what, I mean, do you want us to guess what you've left out, Andrew?
Yeah, they've described the goblin. I left out the actual description of the goblin.
He's white.
Wears a green hat, blue shirt, moon on it, sends his kids to horse camp.
Yeah, I don't even have anywhere else to go with that.
No guesses.
Well, okay. All right.
I'll say. Let's go traditional. What I would think of as a goblin. So, green, craggy skin, pointy ears.
See, I feel like
spindly fingers.
Feel like the thing that Andrew left out has to spell out the actual thing of what it is, right? So
no.
Oh,
this time.
Great. Oh, good. All right. Well, in that case, I got nothing then.
Let's go Uzi pours, a springs for legs, a face made of cardboard.
But a gorgeous voice, like just sounds like heaven when he sings. He comes in singing Moon River on his little ukulele, floating down the South African rivers. It's the most beautiful thing you've ever heard.
Those famous South African rivers.
I'm trying to do a Google search here because there's a wonderful description of what they say, and I'm trying to think of, like, can I find an actual example of this, because so much may be lost in cultural translation. And there was a reason I jumped all over this, because I said, I need to find out more about this. This is fascinating to me, and I think I may have solved a mystery too. I don't want to brag. So they describe the goblin as, the headline is, goblin dressed like rock star terrorizes family.
This is amazing. It's David Bowie. David Bowie is the goblin.
Or maybe David Lee Roth, because let me get you into the description of what he's wearing. Okay?
All right.
The family says they're terrorized by a goblin that looks like a rock star. Apparently it has green eyes and wears a 1980s yellow suit with black stripes and a cross belt.
What?
What? So right, keep in mind, they've also described Bruce Lee and the chick from Kill Bill. So it's true like that. You got a lot of different places.
It's the height of a 3-year-old child, but as the face of a grown man. So as they're describing this,
David
like
Lee Roth.
it's maybe it is David Lee Roth.
Man, can you imagine? Maybe he does. He pops in with his Jawbone Jambox and hits play, and he's all Panama, Panama. I used to be in Van Halen.
I just like the hot for teacher like riff, like walking through the South African house, looking to cuddle some kids.
Oh my!
You gotta get ready to shake your sister, cause they really rock the goblins here.
Hot for goblin.
Guys, I may have this all wrong.
What?
What?
Totally wrong.
What are you talking about?
Yeah. Brian, I'm going to send you some new data here.
Uh-oh, here it comes.
It's an embarrassing mistake to make, but it can happen.
All right, here we go.
Steven Tyler.
I'm looking at his description, the striping, the yellow suit.
Let's take a look here. all right, update for the video watchers. I think we have an artist's composition of what we think.
Oh, no!
All right.
So, by the way, as if, I don't know, it's eerily accurate, but if you look at Sammy Hagar in I Can't Drive 55, as Andrew has just sent over to me, first of all, if I'm not mistaken, that's either Spiro or the Fudge. Right, yeah. Next to capturing Sammy Hagar as a goblin, come Willy Wonka reject.
You know what? I may be wrong on that. There could be more of them too.
What? Oh, hold on.
Sorry. Here, by the way, yeah.
Breaking news, ladies
Sammy
and gentlemen.
Sammy Hagar can drive 55. Look at his outfit there. That is a yellow shirt. But no. How about this Striper Christian metal band?
Man, there's a lot of apparently all it takes is a yellow jumpsuit to make the cross from 80s hairband icon to goblin.
I remember like in the UFO stories when people have the encounter, they go there and they show them like pictures of grays and different ones, like point this out. I'd like to go there with like a bunch of 80s record albums, you know, and can you point them out?
Which just one see, yeah, it? Yeah. Which of these was the band that touched you in your heart with their sweet ballads?
Yeah, so go look up Striper. That's you look up Striper, and that's with a Y. But yeah, there's a lot of David Bowie.
Here it goes, ladies and gentlemen. We are anticipating breaking news here at Weird
Things.
We
try to settle this
now.
Case. Maybe it is. Oh, the
this just in,
all.
Ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. We have yet another artist
of course,
composition.
And then, of course, to recap, so we had David Lee Roth. We had Sammy Hagar. Right now, hey, I'm a goblin. But there's the man himself, David Bowie.
The height of a child with the face of an adult, right?
Well, he's a pretty tall guy, but you know, he's very compelling.
Also, take a look at this. I'm going to drop the take a look down by his feet, and what do you see there?
Oh, a little baby doll. He's just toying with us now. He's been a goblin all along.
Maybe that's him in the middle of transitioning.
Maybe.
Oh, dude. Wait. You guys, it's looking more and more like Bowie.
Okay, once again, breaking news here on the Weird Things podcast. As Brian and Justin... continue to, oh my
Fly
god.
Fly me to Zimbabwe,
damn.
I'll visit you tonight.
Wow.
So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. David Bowie
QED.
Is terrorizing people in Africa.
QED.
That
wow.
might be the most British photo I've ever seen of anybody, let alone David Bowie.
Well, and explain
so
to me,
British.
Explain to me how on earth he has grandma hands. When was this taken? Look at that.
Because he weighs about 40 pounds in that photo.
Hmm. Yeah.
Hmm. Grandma hands.
Yeah.
All right.
So, rock star goblin terrorizing people in Zimbabwe.
All right, here, Andrew, what were the search terms you used so people who are listening to
That's what I want to know is, like, how he kept finding these. Did you just type in rock star yellow?
Yeah, I typed in, like, yellow suit, rock, and then I remembered, and then I looked for David Lee Roth, and one just popped up, and then I typed in, I'm thinking, maybe it could have been Sammy Hagar. So I just, Sammy Hagar can't drive 55.
Do you realize? You realize in this photo, David Bowie has Conan O'Brien's hairstyle, like down to the color.
He does.
In fact,
he has the face of the older brother from Pete and Pete after a meth bender.
How did he ever get a reputation as being beautiful?
I think because Bowie is a beautiful man. I think this is Bowie, probably maybe in his very very party phase, thin phase. You know. Mm. I mean, he looks extremely thin there, ridiculously thin there.
Yeah, grandma hands.
Number one, this is a breakthrough, Andrew. I feel like, you know, we've focused so much on what rock stars could do for Africa, and now we find out that it really is this hidden torment that they
Africa can do for rock stars, and apparently give them a second chance and a second bite at the apple by coming back and rocking out people in the middle of the nights.
Yeah. Gentlemen, ready to change the topic.
Probably a molester, though. it's probably not David Bowie as a goblin. It's probably a molester.
Way to just pull back the curtain on that, Justin. We had a whole vision here. Half of you're like, no, but seriously, it's a molester.
I mean, odds on.
The old. All right,
gentlemen. How would you like to work in a scientific lab?
Oh, are you kidding me? I could feel like smart and see important stuff.
How would you like to maybe like do some important work saving the world from infectious diseases?
I want you, for those of you listening, you could hear the sound of my heart going up into my throat and then sinking to the bottom of my stomach as I realized where this scenario might be going.
All I'm saying is there's some people who have to be on the front lines and they're saving
sure.
us. But you know what? I'm going to put you in like a low security lab, okay? You're low security lab, right?
I mean,
yeah, barely any security, bro.
Security is not the first place I went to. I'm here to help with the cause.
I mean, would you like a lot of security?
You guys are cleaning pipettes.
Okay, you know? Yeah. Cleaning, working in a lab, right on,
dude.
Doing pipettes, you know, getting that
best
stuff.
Best way
clean.
To roll it, man. Where my pipettes at? I'm cleaning them.
Simple stuff, you know, whatever. And then, hey guys, you know what? I'm going to send you guys a present. Y'all got a present. You ready for your present?
Sure. We're just cleaning pipettes.
So you're like, hey, you know, this job's kind of cool. We're not like the guys down in the basement in a secure facility working with like Ebola and smallpox, stuff like that. And like, and they're like, you guys get like a shipment from below. And they're like, here you go, guys. And you're like, that's cool because like we don't work with the dangerous stuff. We didn't sign up for that, right?
Yeah. Hey, man, look around. How much security do you see? Very little. That was our deal. Minimal security.
Dude. But you know, you want to know what you do see? Some clean-ass pipettes.
Oh, my God. Dude, check out this flask. Erlenmeyer. Erlenmeyer flask. Clean.
Dude. Old Ray Erlenmeyer himself would look at that flask and be like, that is clean as
hell. You see this Bunsen burner? I don't know. It's got fire in a tube on it.
Tyrone Bunsen himself would look at that burner and be like, clean.
So see this clean. Dish? This is a Petri dish. Yeah, I bet you don't even know Rob Petrie.
Dude, yeah.
So
Rob
meanwhile,
and his wife Eileen Petrie, who co-invented the dish, would say clean as hell.
So you guys are having discussions about this. You're talking about Game of Thrones, and maybe somebody will bring up some science stuff like, shouldn't we destroy smallpox? You know, that's a big debate right now. Like, we've completely just about eradicated it. We've eradicated it from people. We have the last remaining samples are in laboratories. And we're like, should we just destroy them, you know?
Well, first of all, no, because you never know when you might need it. I mean, just keep it locked up, I guess. And then we could beat it again if it gets out.
So, Justin, what's your thought on that?
I restate the question. I got
should
lost.
We, you know, you guys are talking about should we destroy smallpox?
Yeah, we only got a little bits and pieces of it in some labs everywhere. It's pretty much gone from the world.
Oh yeah, so it would never be around again. No, you got to keep it.
Yeah,
okay. Just in case it gets out,
dude. I don't want to be accused of being on like genetic hoarders, but like you never know.
So are you comfortable that we'd be able to securely keep track of this stuff?
I mean, give or take, sure. I mean, it's like.
It's not like how hard is it? You put it on a piece of paper.
Justin, to put on the shelf over there.
Wait. I'm sorry. What?
Would you hand Justin the box that just came in from receiving?
Well, yeah. No, I mean, here in our low security lab, we're all bros.
So keep going. So you're all for let's keep the smallpox around.
Yeah.
All right, that's fantastic.
Where's it gonna go?
Oh my God, that white powder is anthrax, and it was supposed to be deactivated before we sent it to you guys. Oops, we just potentially infected 75 CDC employees with anthrax. Ourselves.
All right. Well, this sucks, but at least I don't have smallpox.
Yes. Oh,
although it does continue our musical tribute for Weird Things, as now anthrax has come into position.
So 75 employees at the CDC may have been exposed to anthrax because apparently they had to do some research on it. They will do the inactivate, basically kill it, right?
Yeah.
Well, they received a bunch of of anthrax. Had been deactivated. The numbers got up. Now they think 86 employees may have been exposed to live anthrax.
Now, how do they deactivate anthrax? Do they like irradiate it and keep it in powdered form, or what's the story with that?
I think probably, I would imagine, probably use some sort of radiation or something like that.
A friend of mine did his PhD on powder dispersal. Like, this is a weird thing that you wouldn't think there would be room for it in a PhD. But he's a guy who has a background, like, he did the Trinity. Like, he got his undergrad, his master's, and then his PhD, each in a different of the WMD categories, like biology, radiation, and chemistry. And for his PhD, though, he wanted to study, thinking that it would be of use to the military or to whoever, the idea that once a powder disperses, you know, because there's all things you have to consider is like the turbulent nature of how it disperses, how sticky, whether it sticks with, static electricity or by barbs on the actual powders themselves. And he basically spent all this time building devices that would blow various types of powders at, you know, your linoleums, you know, because the question is, how do you clean it? You can't just run in with a vacuum, give it a couple of blows on a carpet and be all like, oh, I'm sure it's all up there. Go ahead, move back in. So
what happened here is that they have like in a level 3 lab where they have the full on thick spacesuit type stuff to work with them. They have it and they were sending it to another lab where it's supposed to be deactivated. And somebody went to go throw out some microscope slides that they'd used to look at it. And they noticed it had been growing on there. And this was supposed to be the dead bacterium. The anthrax had been killed and it hadn't been killed. And they're like, well, 86 people had been around and exposed to this and not using the precautions you would normally use. So far, no reports of fatalities or injuries. They're able to, you know, if they do show signs, they can give them antibiotics. They'll get really good treatment and hopefully nobody get hurt. But it was a procedural error. It was just... somebody marked it deactivated and it wasn't. And
before we get into how safe we all feel keeping these kind of things and putting them in the hands of our fallible human, you know, brains, like if you were working at the CDC, even in a general capacity that you are not expected to be on like total medical lockdown for really, really rough stuff, and you get anthrax because of this, how much is there the feeling of like, yo, man, I work at the CDC? Like, you know, if you work at McDonald's and even if you're not on the fryer later, if you're the one taking money, sometimes you might get splashed with hot oil because there's a hot oil machine right next to it.
I mean, I'm sure they have all kinds of paperwork when you come in to work with that. So they got some kind of, you know, plus also, I mean, you're talking about the same institution that sends people with the stated objective of dying on foreign territory. You know, it's like when you work for the government, I think there's a built-in expectation that the rules are just a little bit different, right?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, hospitals, you know, you're going to be in medical environments, you know, you're going to be exposed to things that you're not going to be elsewhere. And I think there's a certain amount of risk. And, you know, it's just, I just use this as an example. I'm like, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, here's eliminating smallpox is also kind of an example of the gun control debate. Because you could say, like, all right, let's get rid of smallpox so it's never there. Okay, how do we know the Russians got rid of it?
Yeah, I don't trust the Russians to have. I mean, like, we find, like, paintings from old masters at flea markets. Like who knows that we've accurately kept track of every stitch of some disease.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and we've had instances where we thought it was completely gone, and then we find it again. So, but also this shows you procedurally that these are the smartest, most, and as CDCs, these people have saved countless millions of lives through their efforts. And these people are doing heroic work. They are brilliant people. They are doing great work. Accidents happen. In this case, it affects them internally. And that's just the realization of it. No protocol can be perfect if human intervention can screw it up. Merry Christmas.
Well, and plus also, like we've seen this from going back to the 1920s when they when the Zener ESP experiments were happening, right? And they would, the question was how much human error can there be in the testing protocol? And it wasn't his group, but there was some other group that just said, here are the results. All you have to do is write them down. And they noticed that there's a human bias. Like if they believed in ESP, they would tend to make mistakes that would generate more hits than misses versus somebody who is skeptical. So it's like the moment a human touches it, there's something that's going to mess it up. And I assume that's universal.
So another place that we could be finding we could get rid of the smallpox is they think that frozen mummies and envelopes of scabs could contain remnants of smallpox.
Envelopes of scabs? That is the most metal name I've ever heard.
It's my newest band, Justin.
So they had some workers in 2011 were digging a foundation at a site in Queens, and their equipment struck against something metal. Then a body rolled out of the rubble. Thinking they might have unearthed a shallow grave of the murder victim, they immediately called the New York Chief Medical Examiner. They find out this person was probably buried in a nearby church, but again, the CDC comes in because there's a potential for infection. There is a potential that you could have bacterial agents and viral agents and other things that might be able to stay dormant for considerable amounts of time. And so that's another factor, is that we could get rid of it and then it could pop up somewhere else.
I mean, that is the thing right there, where it's like once you think about it as a tactical advantage to have the important material, and there's not a biological arms race happening right now, but certainly it seems like being well armed with, the potential to defend would be a good idea, right?
I agree. And
also, let's label it twice. I propose a 2x labeling solution, in which you label it once and then you label it again, and so as to prevent confusion.
But then also put your initials on there and maybe the date. We'll just say put down the date 2 and and an XOXO on
here's
there.
Here's the thing. Let's even go one step further. Try your favorite animal.
You know what? Let's go a step farther. On all the passwords, just to be safe, let's add a 1 at the end. So whatever the password was, new password is that plus a 1.
Password
at the
1.
End. Yeah.
So I think it's apparently when people would find some sort of mysterious or what they thought was smallpox or something like that, they would scrape off the scab and mail them to.
Oh.
Are there still people who will send baby scabs for chickenpox through the mail? Like you could still buy those?
I don't know. I think that's probably the most disgusting thing we've ever talked about.
No. What the hell are you talking about?
Oh, you don't know about this? Like, no. Okay. Okay.
Do you know about this, Andrew?
The belief is that you should, I don't want my kid to get chickenpox as an adult because then it'll be really bad. Let me give him chickenpox as a kid.
Yeah, chickenpox parties, but yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, this is apparently if you don't have cool friends who happen to have chickenpox around at the time, you can poke around on the internet and you can – parents will have a kid take a lot – who has the chickenpox and slobber on a lollipop, eat it a bit. Then they wrap it up and they put it – I bet I can find one for sale right now. Hold on. I'm going to write here.
What?
Chicken pox lollipop. I'm sorry. Say goodbye to David Bowie. Chicken pox.
It looks like he just had one in that photo.
Lollipops. And here we go. Swapping chicken pox infected lollipops is illegal, according to Reuters. And
what not to buy online?
Here we go.
Lollipops laced with chicken pox.
Chicken pox lollipops helpful. For sale at SheKnows.com. I'm going to see if this is still good. Rogue Movement claims to boost immunity. Yeah. Well, I see, and I don't know if this is like an overinflated thing where it's like, here, let me, I'm going to go to Craigslist. That's what I need to do. Craigslist.org.
Now, this would it have some sort of
disgusting.
Now, like,
here, I'll go to US. I'm going to do a little search. How do I search?
Does it have some other kind of maybe alternate name they use for it now?
Oh, I bet. Hold on. I can't find.
Yeah.
I guess I'll look here in Austin. See what I can find here. Austin.
Order a few.
I need those avian pops. Who's got those avian pops?
Avian pops.
Chicken pox. I'm going to type in here.
Cluck, cluck pox.
Well, there's a 73-inch Mitsubishi TV and 2-month-old pullets young hens for sale. So that's chicken pox. Dang, I'm gonna have to find it. I'll see if
well,
I can find one for you.
I think you've proven that it is a thing.
We like, believe you, like, Brian.
Yeah, I don't think that anybody needs to actually have the link to buy one right now, unless we want to work out an affiliate code with who's ever selling chickenpox infected lollipops. In that case, we'll be sure to give you our dial in Night Attack at checkout so you can get 5% off diseasing your own children in the most perverse and bizarre way possible.
Don't forget the measles M&Ms, guys. Those are really good.
So, I mean, like, is this – like, I don't know. I feel like this would be a good a Bonnie conversation if Bonnie was around. Like just that idea of, like where do you need to be as a parent to be like, this is the best idea is to disease my own children in that kind of
way. But keep in mind that the same impulse that – you would have to do that is the exact same impulse to vaccinate your children. Like, it's not pleasant to go take your baby and have him stabbed with a needle.
Yeah.
But unless you
hate your child.
You accept that pain in order to grant them what you perceive to be long-term immunity. So same thing, only I would imagine just, in a more traditional old-fashioned sense, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for whatever reason, like, the chicken pox party idea of, like, oh, look, The kids down the block have chicken pox. Let's just have them all watch a movie together and, throw some Legos on the ground and let's see if we can get this party started with the chicken pox. Like, for some reason, that seems more inoffensive. Like, the mail order element of it just totally, so here we go. This is a porthole posted in 2011 looking for chicken pox. I know there are a few Northwest mommies who would love the opportunity to expose our little ones to chickenpox if given the opportunity. If you have them or know of someone willing to share, please post here.
That's so weird. Here's one for January 9th. So it's not like, man, pox parties.
It at some point, you hope we come up with a better way to inoculate. And we'll go trying to tell, our children's children, like, oh, they actually used to intentionally infect you with chicken pox.
Well, and I'll tell you, it's a little bit more gross to me because I had earlier this year, I guess 6 months ago, I got shingles, which is a resurgence of chicken pox. If you had chicken pox as a kid, you keep the virus in your body forever. And when it resurfaces as an adult, it is miserable. Having gone through it, I'm not a big fan of the chicken pox parties.
So, like, but would it have been worse if you had gotten chickenpox for the first time as an adult? Like,
I don't know. I know that they put me on some heavy duty antivirals, the same thing they put people who have herpes with Valtrex. They just hammered me with like triple doses on that stuff to get rid of. Here's somebody in Columbus, Ohio. I need chickenpox. I was blessed with chickenpox as a child.
I have a lifetime immunity against the virus, but will manifest as shingles if my immunity to chickenpox is not boosted from time to time. If you have a kid with the bug and would be so kind as to visit for a half hour and get exposed, I will be ever so grateful. I think just hanging around the general area would suffice. Thanks, Bruce.
This guy, first of all, Bruce, I think you're mistaken on the way that works. I don't think hanging around the disease boost your a child with chickenpox is not a recharge cell.
Northwestern mommies contingent that was we read earlier, that was posted 5 days ago.
Yes.
In the Columbus
Craigslist. Oh, man. We need, I know we got doctors listening. I'd like one of them to chime in. You know, it's been a while since we've solicited emails. Do we want to give the Weird Things email or just say reach out to any of us?
Just reach out to
any of us. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Subject Weird Things.
That is bizarre. That is, and not to mention, fairly, as people are pointing out in the chat realm here, fairly pedo-y. That was pedo-centric.
Yeah, if you have a child.
Does your child have chicken pox? If someone in your family has chicken pox, please let me bring my children over to play. We like immunity the old-fashioned way. Oh, my God. Really? Well, I guess that's the other thing, too, is that my kids got vaccinated. So it's like, why even bother now?
So they have like a good vaccine for chickenpox? Like that's like
I assume so.
I don't think we vaccinate for chickenpox.
No, yeah.
No. I'm almost certain that my kids have been taking chickenpox vaccine.
That'd be rad. I mean, that's rad if it's a new thing and we knock off here all we this go. Sanity.
It's the chicken and I know when we were kids that this didn't exist, but
okay, that's I forgot that science advances. the varicella vaccine. There we go.
Yeah. Man, crazy. We just want to excuse us while we all read articles about chickenpox and pox parties.
Yeah, listen, I mean, I don't know. This is a tour de force of an episode, man. Like, I don't think I've had so much fun immediately dovetailing into like gut wrenching horror and disgust by this like barbaric medieval trading of spit and saliva and weird pedos and Columbus.
Yeah. Well, ugh. At least not since this.
Well, that guy, listen, he's actually getting handsomer as we keep showing him this David Bowie picture. I think really the only thing about that I find the funniest is the jaunty way he's holding his cigarette.
Like a little a mini bee dog.
It's just kind of like it's like almost an impossible angle. Like, why would anybody hold a cigarette like that?
All right, what else? What else you got for us, Andrew?
I got one more thing, guys. Kind of weird, not too weird. Kind of interesting. The back and forth. And what's sure to be a little bit more controversy as it starts to get more attention, and we love those sort of things. Is the debate on who the first Americans were, the first people to come to this continent, has continued. And
so I guess, like as
you
I
are the real American.
Fight for the world, that's right. I guess it's not Columbus, of course, and it's not allegedly the Native Americans were there. Are you talking about who discovered it first or who lived here first?
First peoples to live here.
Okay. All right, so you're not talking about like the whole controversy with the Vikings discovering America first.
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, we all know from history that it was the first men who were then defeated by the Andals. they settled the northern land, built the wall, and kept the wildlings on the other side of it.
But the children of the forest.
The children of the forest are I mean, they interacted with the first men.
Yeah. So. There was a while ago, there was some debate because, we think that there may have been two different migrations along Beringia, along the from Siberia over into the Americas. You know, that's been some debate because we think oh, this is the earliest point which we think anybody came here. And then we find, some earlier civilization or some little campsite much further down. I'm like, wow, they made it even further. There was a period in time in Washington they found a body that they thought had maybe potentially European features, and then genetic testing showed that he was Siberian and squashed sort of that, to my understanding. Meanwhile, on the east coast of the United States, and no, somebody says in the chat room, this is the whole Clovis Points controversy. No, Tensor Guy, it's not. They found periodically on the East Coast, they found some spear tips and they found some flints that were very, very European in appearance. And they found these European-style stone tools dating back between 19,000 and 26,000 years at six locations along the U.S. East Coast, in Maryland, in some Delaware, and some other places, and even Pennsylvania. And they've also found some doing dredging, which is kind of interesting. So they look at these spear points, these tips, and they realize these are very European style. And spear tips and designs with those sort of signatures, they're very, very telling because, as Brian will tell you, we talked about before, they don't change radically. You pick up one up, you figure they had to be trading with these people or had to come in contact. Now they've got some genetic information because you have physical evidence. Now I'm looking at some of the genetic information. They found some DNA markers in bones of dating back 15,000 years to people who are, you know, long extinct but who lived in the Americas with genetic markers that match Europeans. And so and you go back for enough time, you had a lot more between the Atlantic that there may have been a pathway from Europe over to the Americas across ice flows, across solid thing. You would have had seals. You would have had a lot of tasty things to eat along the way. And that's the thing is we tend to think about things in a very static, like the world looked like it did today. You go back 20,000 years ago, it looked radically different. Coastlines where they found some of these fragments and being dredged up were 60 miles offshore.
Now when you say forgive me if I missed it, but you described physical pieces. You're saying they found genetic material on the physical, I don't know.
Like, building bones and stuff too when they find
find bits and pieces of people. Okay.
Yeah, they, for instance, like they found like tests on ancient DNA found from an 8,000-year-old skeleton in Florida revealed a high level of a key probably European originating genetic marker. And there are some isolated North Native American groups whose language appears not to be related in any way to Asian originating American Indian populations. So the evidence shows that there may be not one, not two, but potentially three migrations and a much, much earlier migration along the Atlantic coast.
I mean, first of all, this is important and it's important that the work happen. But as you listen to it, there's almost this weird like sports arena tribalism, like, yeah, Europeans first or whatever, like label. But like the farther back you go, the more nonsensical those labels sound.
Yeah, I guess my reaction is that when sometimes when they've been suggesting there's a European, and again, these Europeans are as alien to you and me as, you know, any other people going back 20,000 years ago, they look nothing like us, you know. I guess the problem is there has been a real when it was suggested there could have been, you know, European migrations. It was just the reaction to that was no, absolutely not true, can't happen because it had caused some cultural discord that some people felt like their identity was threatened if it turned out that there may have been some other first peoples. And we find that many people who identify with that share relatively few genes with the first people we know who came over from Siberia. So I guess my point is like, the debate's not settled. We don't know. And it wouldn't surprise me if we find evidence of this and then we find out that there may have been a 30,000-year-old migration through, you know, Siberia, you know. But I guess my point is that there was just this fearful – people were sometimes fearful of suggesting, well, maybe Europeans didn't come here. What does that mean? Nothing. It's just historically interesting.
Yeah. Like where does that identification – I mean, is it just a cultural marker that we want to defend and say like, oh, well, like I am special because I am of something else or however else we dice up our cultural biases?
You know, for sure. And I think the thing that we're realizing more and more as we start looking at the genetic information is people are not very isolated. The genes have been flowing back and forth for thousands of years. And, you know, you have Northern European civilizations were getting genes from the Middle East much later on than they, you know, than we acknowledged or realized that, you know, along with culture and other things that, you know, the interconnectedness is much stronger than we realize.
Yeah. Well, like to me, the moment that hit home is when you started hearing, casually people mentioning, oh yeah, no, up to 10% DNA, Neanderthal DNA. And it's like, are you kidding me? That's not even allegedly the same species. Like once you've crossed that border, how weird is it that someone's great-great-grandfather had sex with someone else's great-great-grandmother from, you know, Asia or South America or Australia or wherever?
Absolutely. And so I think that – but it's a very interesting part in the story, and we have to come to a point where we have to say, okay, what some people may – feel culturally threatened by is irrelevant to what's important to understand in the science of how these things work. You know, and there are some indigenous Native American belief that they started here.
Like, let me ask you guys this. How important, because I maybe I'm wrong on this. Now, keep in mind, I come from a background culturally from what we've been able to gather I'm very much like a blended culture. I've been told that there's a lot of English in me, a lot of Norwegian, a lot of some Canadian Indian, some Italian, all this stuff, where it's like maybe it's just where I'm from, but I don't understand it when people say, no, it's important we keep our culture alive or keep it preserved or whatever. Like, is that important? Like, to me,
no.
The faster we get to the point where nobody cares where you're from, the better. But I
agree.
Someone explain to me the opposite side is, I guess, what I'm saying.
I just want to give one more quick aside as far as the origins question, because the problem has been is that we've often had roadblocks in trying to do genetic research in certain when we find really, really, really old bodies, because some Native American groups are like, absolutely not. You can't do any research this on whatever. We're going to put a lockdown on it. We don't want to allow it. But they may be no more related to said body than you or I. And
right.
That gets to be a problem, is that you, when you want to do research, and that's not as big a problem I'm making out to be. And most Native Americans are very open to the research and are very interested in considering it a fascinating thing, because they know that it doesn't diminish one ounce what cultural and significant contributions they've had. So as far as that, like, I Brian, like, I hear what you're saying, that the people are like, oh, we got to, I'm all for preserving language and preserving these things, but not forcing the next generation to do that. I think let not at the expense of the individual.
I mean, I don't even know that I'm for preserving it. I mean, I don't know. I say preserve it exactly how we preserve the smallpox virus, you know, like, let someone's
label it
job
twice.
Exactly.
Well Brian, that's what I mean is one is, you know, let's record it. Let's archive it. Let's make it widely available. That's how I mean by preserve it. The other thing too, is I think that there is in some cultures, there's been this hesitation to teach other people these things, the languages and stuff, the folk songs, as they want to keep it within their own genetic group. When there might be some kid in Nova Scotia who would love to learn some of these, you know, more obscure songs Pacific Islanders know or whatever. And it's like, listen, you got to give up on one thing. You either got to give up the culture or you got to give up the genes.
Well, I feel like in terms of like preserving culture, quote unquote, I mean, like, I can understand it as like a marker of our human history and like the story of where your family came from and understanding that. I agree with you though, Brian, that like, if you are taking anything more from that other than like, oh, look, this is what people that were related to me did, then you are doing, I personally don't quite see the benefit of it. And more troublingly, it can tend to be the like coded language of really destructive and negative thought.
I mean, you're getting at tribalism, right? The whole idea that,
well,
that it's like,
yeah,
no,
we
got to keep our team in the game.
Because of this, and because of this history, we are now more naturally predisposed to do X, Y, or Z. You know, like, I think that's frustrating.
I mean, it's weird because at the one time we're seeing the end of a lot of tribalism where people are less interested about where they're from, but we're seeing the beginnings of other types of tribalism. For example, the community that supports this show, you know, as we call them, Chat Realm, spans all the entire world, you know, all over the world. People, you know, call in and participate from Scandinavia, from Estonia, from the United States, from South. We have people in South America right now watching and commenting in the chat. And so in one regard, we all give up our biological, geographic, tribalistic locations, but then we take up ideological tribal, you know, because there is sort of unifying themes between, you know, there's certainly a bit of a cult of a personality for the kinds of people that people come in on this. I don't know. I would rather see tribalism based on ideology than just the genetic lottery.
Yeah, I think that, and also too, it's like, you know, some tribes or some groups or cultures are very easy to adapt into bigger ones and all that. And, you know, in the comment section, there's somebody making a remark about like, I assume if you're saying if you're white Protestants, whatever, you don't have to worry about preserving your culture. Well, white Protestants came from a very, very large area and many, many different languages, many, many different languages, you know, and there's a number of people who I know very, very next to nothing about my Scandinavian ancestors. You know, I don't know. I don't speak Swedish. I don't speak Norwegian. I know somewhere a lot of my relatives popped up in Kentucky, and I know nothing about that. I don't know anything about Kentucky folk songs, Kentucky folk music. There's a whole history of all that there. I have no idea what any of that is.
He doesn't even watch Justified. Like,
he hates Kentucky bourbon. He didn't even vote for Rand Paul. That's a fact. Yeah,
and in fried chicken, not even on the top 10 for favorite foods.
I mean, sure, he's heard of Dollywood. Never been there, though.
Tried.
That's Tennessee. Never mind.
Knows all the lyrics to My Old Kentucky Home, however.
But you get, the point is, it's like that a lot of that gets lost all the time. And, you know, you can look forward to look backwards, and it would be great to preserve that, but not at the expense of an individual not having the choice to make their choose their own destiny.
It's tough because I know that part of what draws us together is that we tend to have similar ideas. So this is another one that I would love to hear somebody present the other side, because I bet somebody could explain it to us.
The thing about and to defend the cultural argument is that, like, you can't have that taken away from you. You know, you can be a certain class and then not that class. You can be a certain ideology and then fall out with the main line of where your peer group kind of thinks. If you are of a certain culture, then that's something that you can always say, I am this. You know, there is, I think, almost an orientation point element to it that is helpful. That, you know, like, I know where I am based on where my family has been.
I will give you an example of this, watching this in play. So I spent the last week at this thing called Adventures of the Mind. They bring 200 high school kids from around the country to a campus. In this case, it was Occidental College, and they bring in a lot of very different, interesting people. We had the author, Amy Tan, was there. Paleontologist Jack Horner. We had astronauts, Nobel Prize-winning physicists. Just a great, great collection of people. And then me. And we had two of my favorite speakers, a lot of great speakers. Two of my favorite speakers was, on one hand, we had Ben Ha. He's the guy that does I Can Has Cheeseburger. Mm-hmm. So he's a guy that's just produces tons and tons and tons of this content that takes up a short amount of your time. All these memes, cat memes, all this other stuff. And so he's a guy who's been a prolific purveyor of this kind of short attention span content. And then we had James Ellroy talk, celebrated crime novelist, the movie L.A. Confidential, based on his books. He did a lot of stuff in the Black Dahlia murders, etc. This is a guy that doesn't own a cell phone, doesn't have email, and totally says he's plugged, doesn't plug into any kind of technology, all that. Writes his novels long form using yellow legal pads. Did a wonderful, wonderful talk where he does his things and speaks as sort of this rhyming sort of pattern and uses all sorts of big fancy words like tumescent, and got these kids and nobody, I started cracking up, nobody knew what he's, you tumescent teenagers. I'm like, that's hilarious. nobody around me knew what he meant. None of the adults that I was immediately around understood, but anyhow, he would start, and he would swear, he would do all this stuff, great speech, but he made this case for, like, the idea that the long form attention is gone. Long form attention's gone. People just don't read as much. He kind of railed against a lot of the modern, dividing your attention and all these other places. And he has one cultural value that's same group of people, same physical space that we're all in, but he has his idea of what preserving cultural means. And then Ben Ha talks about the idea that he uses an example of how it used to be culture was sort of this big, thick, deep dish pizza. Now it's a big, thin crust pizza that's much, much wider. It's the same amount of stuff there, but it's spread all over. And it was just interesting to see the two different approaches towards that, and it was a cultural war, a cultural discussion.
I mean, I don't first of all, I mean, sure, let's say you say, I'm going to use, the universal you say, ooh, that that long-form content is dying. Yeah, exactly. But to me, it's like, so what? We have a more efficient mode of communication. Clearly – to me, what's so great about the fact that you wrote longhand, that just means you wrote fewer novels and they're in your life. Like, we're only, we're mayflies. We get one day on this stupid planet, and let's do more efficient modes of communication.
I will play the devil's advocate. Okay. And I am with you. I think whatever you choose to choose. And I also make the argument long form isn't dying. Children's novels keep getting thicker and thicker and thicker. I bet you Penny has read more books this year than I have.
That she read all of the Harry Potter series in 2 weeks. Like, that is she is 10 years old and just came back with a vengeance on it. Now she's started the Dark Materials series. I mean, she has read so much, and it's like, I don't know. Don't weep for the youth. They're smarter than we are already.
But I'll say this, like, There's the fear of what we might be missing. There's the fear of, like, you know, we know now that people who take notes, actually handwritten notes, have much higher retention than people who try to do notes electronically. That's one of the problems. You know, people often have trouble remembering the titles of books that they read on Kindles versus actual physical books, because once you get past that first page, you never encounter the title or the author again unless you look up above. You know, that can be that. And so there's the fear of what we might be missing. There's the fear that, is there something to be gained in spending 500 words with an author and living in that universe and not having your attention pulled out of it, that you're going to have a much more complete thought or experience? Justin.
I agree. I mean, I think the only thing that we don't I would, in this conversation about tribalism, like, I don't want to go too hard on, you know, like, well, and that's why he's wrong, because we're internet people and we're right and we do digital things.
Yeah, down with the Luddite tribe. Yeah. Boo.
We're here on the internet tribe. We don't have tribalism, unlike those assholes who write on paper. So, like, I think I tend to, obviously, spend my entire time plugged, my entire day plugged in on some level. And I believe that my life is infinitely better for it. And it is, like, I can list the reasons why I think it is awesome. But if somebody, like, doesn't see that, then, like, all right, man, like, it's just like your opinion.
Right. Well, but even then, like the case against it, and this is something that I read in Trust Me, I'm Lying, where the guy, number one, tells the story of how he became successful by manipulating the right now culture of the blogosphere and the insatiable demand to come up with, you know, 7 to 12 stories per day in order to keep the lights on. And he spends the last half of the book lamenting the fact that somehow, like, we're worse off for it. And he makes points of people who, you know, get excoriated unfairly because something blows up or whatever. But I would say that while there, you could certainly point to individual moments of inefficiency where somebody gets, you know, just hammered. But you've always been able to see that. We still know Richard Jewell as the Atlanta Olympic bomber, even though he was 100% exonerated over that. This is before the blogosphere. This is before any of that crap. This was the only thing different is instead of a constant, you know, 10-minute news cycle, there was a 24-hour news cycle. And the impulse for us to overstate, to sensationalize it, to blow up has always been extremely human. The only thing that's changed is the iterative pace that it's happening now.
And all that in, like, a great example that was made, again, Mr. Hodden, we talked about, was that, like, I've always hated science editors. Always hated science editors because they would cover a topic, they would go for the most sensational thing they could, yep, and then move on and never revisit it when it was refuted or whatever. And I used to write letters and be ignored because they didn't care. Now through blogging, now you can talk about, like, you know, the Mars Curiosity product. You know, hey, it just launched. A couple weeks later, hey, we just had the successful deployment of this part of it. Boom, hey, it's on its way. And then later on, they pick up the story of it landing, and you have these stories that continue on throughout. Now, traditional old-form journalism, they might have like a 500, 800-word piece on it, and then they would move away from it. But here you have if you just look at this one bit, like, oh, that's not much, but you need to follow this thread straight across, you get a much more comprehensive story because we want to come back to it, and you can have all sides of it.
I mean, from having worked in print journalism newsrooms, like, what would you rather have? This infinite stream of small articles or a news hole of, in a major metropolitan news section, you're probably looking at 10 to 14 original articles, and then you take the rest from The Wire, which is even more dangerous because it's, you know, something, someone gets something wrong, it's just reprinted throughout, you know, off the AP or Getty or UPI or something like that. So it's in my mind, it's like, yeah, listen, what the internet has done is given us a far greater and detailed look of how these things happen and why they happen and the points in which there are failures. And now with their, you know, yeah, it's violent to watch the process in motion, you know, when somebody screws something up and then it just gets really, really ugly, really, really fast. But well, it's always gone on.
It and I'll tell you what you're talking about is a side effect of this culture of heterogeny that we have, you know, where it's like the internet is a very fast moving, and I'm going to say the internet, but I'm talking about the whole, you know, 24-hour blogosphere culture where, you know, there's bite-sized things that can explode on the internet side. It is a volatile market of ideas. There's big swings up and down, but in general, one of the side effects has been the fact that there's no need to, I'm not going to say there's no need, but we've seen a massive decrease in the dumbing down of science as it's presented to the mass culture. Back in the day, like you were saying, you had to pick one of three stories from the wire in order to figure out what you're going to put on. You're going to do whatever has the biggest appeal that you're not worried about losing people on. Nowadays, we don't have to worry about that. Somebody, for every one blogger that decides he's going to play it safe and make it palatable for the masses, some other blogger is going to give the hard numbers and explain to you the physics behind it, that it's going to be a much more dense article. And I feel like mankind is winning as a result universally because we again, it's iterative. We get more iterations. We get more at-bats for important ideas of the speed.
Who wins are the people who want to go deeper.
Yeah.
You know, because there is still the same stupid article that would have been run in a major metropolitan paper on Elite Daily above the 10 freeze frames from Orange is the New Black that you absolutely must see and why I've started dating women instead of girls. Like, you know, like there that is still there.
Yeah.
But what's different is that if in the one person in the comment that's like clickbait, stupid, this is why it's wrong, there is now a thread that you can follow. And also, that dumb article is more, we think of it as something that would go up on a BuzzFeed or one of the Facebook things and not the only name in news that you would previously be able to read.
Yeah.
It's like your daily paper or you know, like the media as media has grown, like at least dumb stuff, although still popular and still will always be read by a certain element of society that just doesn't want to take the time. And fine, whatever. They might want to focus on other stuff. But if you care to do it, you are able to go deeper.
So tell me this, and I want to get both Andrew and Justin on this, and I know we're about to wrap up here, but it seems to me that the flip side of this, the counter argument is that that it used to be that you had to have public discourse and you had to read the other side of the story because there was only one newspaper in your town, so you had to read it and understand other people's ideas. Whereas nowadays, you could spend all day watching MSNBC, Fox News, insert whatever, and live in your own silly bubble. Like, do you feel like the increased ability to shape the feed of the input to your own news brain is I mean, I understand the words of the argument, but I don't believe a single word of it. Do you feel like there's any downside to the ability to wrap yourself in a bubble for all of mankind?
I think that it's harder to be in that bubble now. I think it's much harder to stay in that bubble. But I think if you want the bubble, you can choose the bubble. You always could choose the bubble. You meet people who are. It's interesting. You talk to people who left the Church of Scientology. Okay. Who were involved in Sea Org or involved in those levels. And they talk about things. And I remember talking to one guy talk about, like, he said, yeah, I said, like, I knew who Clinton he was involved when Clinton was president. Like, because I knew Clinton vaguely was president, but I didn't know anything about it. Didn't care. And you find out a lot of these people just are totally, I guess the word right, we're just ignorant of politics or the world around them. And I've met people, I remember talking to a guy, really, really successful businessman, real estate, all that, multi-millionaire. Didn't know who Larry King was.
Wow.
And I'm like, Larry King, this guy's been around since Moses. Idea who he was. It was not in his role, didn't care, didn't involve with any of the business he was involved with, and was completely immune to that. So, you know, that was a discussion with somebody 15 years ago. So,
I mean, my guess is, like, I understand how for one person it could be a tragedy that this one person is wrapped in the bubble instead of trying to understand all lives. Or all sides. But I feel like allowing the existence of those bubbles for those people to wrap themselves in general, is part of a general culture of, again, heterogeneity that I think is benefiting man pretty well. Because on the fringes, you do have people looking at both sides.
But I I think most people are in bubbles, though. I mean, I think that it's that you know, when somebody gets angry listening to some other side or some other aspect of it and upsets them, it's because they're so far off on their own sort of sin. They're so into their own sort of tribe or their own way of thinking that they're totally oblivious to how they're in a bubble. And that's why, you know, people who I think are a little more open to what all those are, don't get upset. You know, you can watch anything, either whatever. But I think people who have the strongest allergic reaction to this, it's because their immune system is much more weaker than they realized. And they're probably much more in a bubble than they want to acknowledge.
And I don't know how much more I can say that Andrew hasn't said more eloquently, but like the idea of these confirmation biases, like they've been there forever. There's more that we can, there's more different content that caters to every element of it. But I don't really know where it's different than just not paying attention to stuff if you don't like what is being said to you, you know, which was like the previous way to keep yourself in a bubble is just to busy yourself doing other stuff. It's like before there were internet message boards and before there was, you know, Twitchy or you know, Think Progress or whatever you want to, you know, align yourself with and whatever shirt you want to put on and yell about how the other shirts are dumb. Like you could just go and not pay attention to the news because you thought that they were run by people that you didn't agree with. And you could still get magazines or you could get a leaflet or you could scratch on the same rock that all your friends scratched on. Like, whatever. It's always been there. It's just now it's just colorful and fun and it boosts your clout score.
Gentlemen, time for picks.
Boom.
I'll tell you what I'm reading right now. I don't know if this is a pick. It's been I've enjoyed it. It's been a little tedious in that it's a overbroad story, so that as a result, there's a lot of things that I had run across peripherally before, but it's all correlated into a very cogent narrative that tells the story of the human body, and it's called "The Story of the Human Body" by Daniel E. Lieberman. And it talks about our relatives, from archaeologically speaking, or that's not the word. You say what is it? Anthropologically. There you go. Anthropologically. Wow, I can't talk. At any rate, I'm enjoying it. I'm almost done with it. It makes some good cases talks. It dips a little bit into the unsettled science of how much of what we do day to day is what our bodies have evolved to do, and is the trade-off worth it? You know, whether it's, you know, talking about nowadays, what we do is if you have flat feet, then they make sure to give you orthotic shoes to support your flat feet. But in that case, you never strengthen your arch, so you have flat feet forever. And whereas historically, there's a whole movement of runners who run barefoot, and virtually none of them have flat feet because they're treating their feet the way they're evolved to do. However, doing things the way you're evolved to do isn't necessarily better either, because you're built to live until about 35 and then drop dead from malaria or whatever. So I think it gives a fairly balanced explanation. And of course, I'm talking about the modern aspect of things because that's what the last third of the book focuses on. But the first talks a lot about the artifacts that we have from the early days of trading. And we talked last week or the week before about the hand axes that people were making and so on. It's good stuff.
Yeah, it's real quick. It's interesting because like there was a much, much bigger like, run without shoes. You're meant to do that kind of thing. And then after a number of people started doing that for a while and were getting tremendous amounts of injuries and realizing that, you know, unless you're doing it since you're from childbirth and built up the really thick thing on your skin, it's not a good idea.
Well, and he also says
shoes are better.
I believe the counter argument, and again, he doesn't really have a dog in the fight. He just reports what each side says. You know, people say that like with shoes, when there are injuries, they tend to be bigger injuries because, I don't know, for reasons, because parts of you get weaker or whatever. But he does make the sensible argument, and he even gets into the whole, whether or not reading too much causes myopia. And I don't know enough about it at all. But, you know, he points out that, the worst case scenario, maybe it's okay to have your kids experience sight in more ways than just 3 feet in front of their face on there. But at any rate, I would love for some scientist, the way he represents it is that it's debated, but I don't know if that's the case. That's easy for somebody to weasel in what might end up being a pseudoscientific idea in there.
Well, there was my chance. I'm going to show you another pick.
Is it a pop-up book?
Oh, yeah. Remember how last time I showed you guys the...
I love how this is rapidly becoming Uncle Andrew's pop-up time.
Oh, my God. Oh dude. Eventually, it's going to be the whole show.
He's off camera right now, off retrieving.
Remember we had the science pop-up, the Amazing Science? Now this is beyond amazing.
Yeah, beyond amazing.
Did I show you this one with the hourglass?
You did. Yeah. A functioning hourglass that you could put in there?
Well, now I got the other missing parts, too. I got a complete one, which includes... Oh, what's that? I'm looking at you guys.
Oh,
I'm seeing
gosh.
You.
Freaking binoculars. That's amazing.
Pop open binoculars. Right. And move past there. You know, maybe I want to talk to somebody. And maybe I take this little pop-open sort of construction, take the little wire to it, and attach it to the other pop-open one. And I have a little telephone. I'm like, hey, what's going on, guys?
Wow.
Good to hear from you. What? Yeah, no. Yeah, she's coming over right now. That's right. So don't even bother to come by. Knock on the door.
So seriously, right? don't let us see the two of us talking into tin can telephones.
I don't think you appreciate this technology. I can actually... send sound information to somebody across distances with it.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So anyhow, this is another one of these really cool books. And again, this is the Beyond Amazing. If you have a kid who's into science or you have a child like Lee yourself, Beyond Amazing, Six Spectacular Science Pop-Ups. You can get it for like $1 plus shipping on Amazon for if you buy it used. You got to be careful because some of them are missing parts, but this one doesn't. I brought these and I brought one of these in my Game of Thrones pop-up to do one of my talks this week, and the kids loved it. Because I talk about, like, if you're going to want to – when you're trying to build things for, let's say, disaster relief, space exploration, or doing scientific research in hard-to-reach places, building small things that pop open and serve a good purpose are very, very useful.
Well, so. And it's funny how the limitations are what makes –
the hardcover from 1 cent.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's amazing. That's because amazing. This is a case where you have very strict limitations, but those limitations are what allow you to come up with, you know, these incredible inventive solutions.
I'm sure this is just more of a fun one. This is this is the space station, pop-up alien space station. You open it up and actually has like little aliens and ships and stuff. You have these little pop-open ships that you can see if I can pop open. And so they're pretty cool. But the real fun part is the playset that emerges from here. And as far as a kind of an awesome media, gentlemen, I need you to step back for your monitors. I don't want you to get hurt.
Uh-oh.
Boom.
Holy crap. Jeez. That is extraordinary.
So for audio listeners, which is most of you, I've just made a giant, humongous
city.
It's like a big, huge space station that is... you know, 2.5 feet across, 2 feet tall. It's got platforms, all sorts of little walkways. There are little alien dudes there in different locations. It's humongous. And so the book, you fold all the pages out like that. These are one of my favorite kinds of pop-up books where you just flip all the page, you flip it around and it pops open or something.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm like about 5 feet back from the camera in order for you to see the whole thing.
That is amazing, dude.
That's insane.
Right on. What about you, Justin? What are you doing?
We've had such an amazing conversation today about the trials, tribulations, and treasures of other cultures. We have railed against the fruitlessness of tribalism, which is why I want to remind everybody that this comes from the United States of America, where the World Cup is about to be won by the United States soccer team. Woo! USA! USA! USA!
Does the U.S. actually have a chance? Is it looking good?
So yeah, no, I've been watching a lot of the World Cup, which has been a really, really good job of presenting it by ESPN and ABC. But they play right after we're done recording, 3 p.m. Pacific time, 6 p.m. Eastern time. The U.S. plays Portugal for a chance to advance out of the group stage. It would be a big, fun thing. But, you know, it's one of those things where I'm not a huge soccer fan. I really don't like it all that much and to watch it in general. But the World Cup's always, like, it's so well shot. It's like the top level of talent that it's hard not to just kind of get sucked into it.
There's a really good Freakonomics episode that just came out last week talking about why the U.S. doesn't seem to ever care about the World Cup. And it explained why the World Cup is so much bigger and why the U.S. can't bust through it. You know, we have homegrown sports like baseball, and when our team wins the World Series, we proclaim our team from our league only competing against other Americans as the world champions or whatever. But, you know, it's sort of an empty boast since so few of the world plays baseball. However, out of all the games, you know, football is the number one sport. And, you know, with that the case, you know, it's no wonder that the U.S. has a hard time to really dominate, because it's not a sport that we care a lot about.
I will. The Toronto Blue Jays would disagree with that statement.
Okay, all right, fair enough, fair enough. Touché, sir. But certainly continental-wise or whatever. But it's really good. If you want to listen to kind of the math of why the U.S. never seems to care or do well at soccer or football, I highly recommend it.
Well, this is, the last 20 years now, the United States as an organization, like the United States national team as an organization has really tried, you know, like they've tried to make strides, and the team has run in a lot different way now, pretty much ever since we got the World Cup in 94. That was the first time that that we really cared about it in a big way, and we haven't really stopped. But now we got about as good of a team as we've ever had. We have a coach that is considered to be world renowned. So we'll see what we can do. Another side pick, which is an anniversary that just passed, June 17th, 1994, is an amazing documentary. I don't know if you guys can find if it's still on Netflix, but it is exceptional. It was for the ESPN 30 for 30 series. It's a documentary with no narrators at all. There's no talking heads. There's no narration. It is just as if you were flipping through the channels on June 17th, 1994. It was O.J. Simpson, the famous white Ford Bronco chase. The Knicks were playing
against the Rockets, because I remember I lived in Houston watching that.
The New York Rangers had just won the Stanley Cup and were doing their ticker tape parade.
Jack Nicklaus's last game.
Listening to this, and they're like, this is so boring just to listen to what you are talking about. But, like, if you enjoy documentaries, you need to watch it. It is so unique and so compelling.
This is one of those documentaries that Justin made me watch, and I'm so glad I did. Like, I'm not naturally a sports person, but I remember that day, and it was amazing watching it recreated. And if there's one takeaway, man, OJ look guilty as hell.
Man, did OJ look guilty? Holy smokes.
I remember watching that with a buddy, and we were hungry. And again, it's 1994, right?
Yeah.
We're hungry, and we want to go get something to eat. So what do? I get out my battery-powered television, okay? We drive with it over to Miami Subs, sit it on the counter, and eat our sandwiches and watch the chase as it unfolds. And people are walking in, they're like, that's cool. They gathered around to go watch this little black and white battery operated TV, because we're like, this is amazing. And, you know, now that just seems so trivial and silly, because, you know, pull out your phone. But that's what I had to do, is to carry this big black and white TV, you know.
That's amazing.
By myself.
Yeah, that was it's so unique to watch, you know, and also they do a great job of showing a lot of the unaired broadcast footage, like of like Bob Costas, who is announcing that the Knicks game, like getting the feed into his ear of what is happening in the O.J. Simpson
As he has to explain to all of the Houston Rockets and Knicks fans that they're going to stop showing this finals game in order to show them, you know, a car driving down the street.
Yeah, or like that's going to be the halftime. I think it was like, that was like the halftime show was they went to the fallout from all that. It is, yeah, no, it's awesome. It's so good.
Fun little bit of trivia, and this didn't really make big news. Do you know what O.J. Simpson? O.J. Simpson was actually on the board of directors of a very well-known brand and company, and it never really got out. And
what, Hertz?
Swiss Army Knife.
Good Lord.
I have a friend that ended up getting his board seat. He said, yeah, so I took a seat. So yeah, they were very glad that that was not really brought to attention that he was sitting on the board of Swiss Army.
Wow.
Fun times. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been weird.